Next item on the agenda is item 5, L. Scott Trainum 09-0806. Mr. Owen, I note that I've received while I was away on a family emergency request for a continuance from Scott Reichel of Patton, Warnham, Hatton, and Diamondstein. Have you been provided a copy of that?
Yes, sir. Sorry.
I think what would be the appropriate thing to do at this juncture is to hear from Mr. Reichel as to why he believes a continuance is in order. Opposing counsel, I believe, is here to address opposition to the continuance, and then I may have some questions for you specific to the case, if you would. So if we can hold that. Mr. Reichel, are you present, sir?
Yes.
Could you come forward, please? First, let me apologize for not personally getting back in touch with you. I was in Ohio attending to the passing of my wife's father. So I always get back on these matters, except as a situation where I did not have the ability to, or knowledge to get back to you. So I just wanted to let you know that.
I appreciate that.
You have a request for continuance?
Yes, I do, Mr. Bowman and members of the commission. A couple things I'd like to point out.
Sir, could you identify yourself?
Yes, ma'am. It's Scott Richley, attorney of the firm Patton, Warnham, Hatton, and Diamondstein.
Excuse my mispronunciation.
Oh, that's okay. Doesn't look like it sounds. Let me just identify, by the way, also who I am here on behalf of. This is, if you see the 102 Creek Circle, I know it's probably far from the far end of the room there, the project site. There are multiple homeowners that have retained me, including but not limited to, if we look at the street that's directly across from the project. Including this home, which is the 114, which is the home of Anthony and Elise Bavuso, Anthony Bavuso and Elise Pyle. The next one here after that, which is that is Frank and Carol and Aunt Caro. The next house down from that, which is Eric and Kelly Aunt Caro, and then also the two homes past them, which would be the homes of the Mary Loesch and Carol Collier. There are multiple other homeowners also that are also contributing to me being here that are include homes that are further down York Point Road. And there's, as you commission probably remembers, there's two additional streets that come down over here. And some of those homeowners are also involved in some extent. But I wanted to identify these because these are the homes that are directly across from the project site. Just a couple of thoughts I'd like to present to the commission regarding the request for a continuance. I was just recently retained in this matter. As you know, I did not participate with regards to the matter before the Wetlands Board or the appeal in front of this commission relating to that. Immediately upon being retained, I did contact Mr. Owen and told him that I was retained, that I expected I would need additional time. At that point, the matter had not been set for today's date as of yet. Told him that I would likely request a continuance because I felt we needed time to evaluate the project. As soon as the matter was actually set then for the hearing date, which was within a week, I made a written request for the continuance. And in that, one of the primary reasons you see that I'm requesting the continuance is that we would like to have an independent expert evaluate the design on behalf of the surrounding homeowners. In that vein, we have retained an expert, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, Dr. David Basco from Old Dominion University. I have several copies here, although it's probably not enough for everybody up there that I can pass.
What is this?
This is basically two things. This is, first of all, a email from Dr. Basco confirming that he has been retained and what he is planning to work on, and confirming that, in fact, he does need additional time to complete his analysis. And then I've attached behind that a copy of Dr. Basco's curriculum vitae for those who are not familiar with him, although once again, I expect most of you all.
Sure. Council, any opposition?
No, sir. If I could get a copy.
Thank you, Mr. Richard.
You see from Dr. Basco's email, which is on the top, that he confirms that when he first learned of the project was on April 13th, and that he's retained 3 days later on April 16th, that he has conducted a site visit on April 23rd and confirms that what he'll be reviewing will be the size of the proposed project and the need for coastal erosion mitigation at the location, potential mechanisms for sand to move in and out of the project area with possible shoal and that could possibly shoal and block the navigation channels, and the size and footprint of the project, especially at the south end. As you can imagine, this is a very busy time for Dr. Basker. The academic year is just wrapping up. Because he has a PhD also, he's not only responsible for teaching, administering finals, but also has multiple graduate students he has to oversee the work of, and all of that is hitting right now.
Is he here today?
He is not. He could not be here today because he has senior design projects, which are apparently ongoing, and there's no way that he could get away for today. With regard, just a couple other thoughts just quickly about that. What I'm requesting commission to consider is 60 days for continuance. As Dr. Basco indicates in his email, that's how much by the middle of June he can complete his analysis. And from my discussions with him, I believe he is intending to coordinate with both Scott Hardaway and Mr. Van Landingham with regards to his findings. And I will tell the commission also that I did also meet with Mr. Van Landingham last week.
Thank you.
I have an email from him also that was sent to Mr. Owen.
Thank you.
And Mr. Van Landingham in that confirms that, you know, he would be, we met with him, he was very aware of Dr. Basker was, and said he would, you know, be interested in reviewing Dr. Basco's findings and consider that. Once again, he's not in a position to do that until we can complete the report. Just a couple last thoughts. I'd like to emphasize to the commission that I know this matter has been going on for a long period of time, first of all. That being said, the issue that's before the commission now that's finally ripe, in essence, for analysis is the issue with regards to navigation. There's been it was very clear from when I listened to the recordings from the prior appeal that the commission in its reversal made it clear that they felt like the issue of navigation was not ripe at the prior hearings. It was only 10 days ago that my clients got the official notice that the hearing with regards to the navigation would be heard. So officially they only had 10 days notice of when that matter is going to be heard. Now, I recognize that I anticipate that counsel for the applicant will say, well, that may be true. They've only officially had 10 days notice, but this has been ongoing since last fall. And the thing I would like to emphasize with regards to that is two points. Once again, all those proceedings were supposed to be dealing with the wetlands according to the view of the commission. And once again, Dr. Basco is being hired more to analyze the navigational aspects of the project. The second thing I'd like to point out is because the people who are objecting actually prevailed at the Wetlands Board, they did not anticipate needing an expert. In essence, they had won at that level, felt that, at that point that it was now, did not anticipate being reversed by the commission because they had a unanimous decision by the Wetlands Board. And it was only at the reversal last month when that was reversed that they realized, wait a minute, we have an issue, we better, at which point they hired me and immediately advised we needed to get technical expertise here to involved in the project. I know from your prior comments that there's been a reoccurring theme, which is, and I respect this from the commission, that you don't want to make rulings based on speculation, that you want to make your rulings based upon science. In that vein, that's why my clients are going through considerable expense to hire somebody who I think everyone will agree has an extraordinary amount of expertise in this area. And frankly, I think it would be to everybody's benefit to have somebody else independently to look at this project and make their own recommendations, to look out after their interest, to also coordinate with BIMS and recreation and conservation, and come back and evaluate it then. It will only give you more knowledge, more technical analyses for you to base your decision upon. And the last thing I'd like to comment on is because of the finality of the decision, once the permit is approved and this is done, the long-term effects are significant. Once again, it's an unimproved piece of property at this point. I recognize it's been going on. The permit's been going on for some period of time. But considering the risk of if the decision is wrong and the fact that there is no true urgency here, this project, this parcel has been as it is for years and years, another 60 days really doesn't have any significant detrimental effects, whereas it can, you know, it could have major impacts if you allow us to go ahead and do the additional analysis. Finally, I just like to mention that if in fact you do deny the continuance, then obviously we'll move forward today as best we can. I'd like to obviously reserve my right to come back up and address the matter on the merits.
Well, absolutely. Any questions of the council? Thank you, Mr. Grissom.
Thank you.
Mr. Daniel, would you like to respond? Would you like to respond to the gentleman's request for continuance, please?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, John Daniel with Troutman Sanders, appearing this morning on behalf of Scott Trainum. As a matter of courtesy almost, I hate to come before you to oppose request of counsel for a continuance in this matter. However, given the equities of the circumstance, I am compelled to do so this morning. As you know, and as was just indicated, this project has been going on a substantial amount of time. The project, while the joint permit application was filed in June of 2009, the official notice that we would ultimately be here at this commission having this hearing was published in July of 2009, almost a year ago. So those who might claim they had 14 days of notice to get ready for this hearing must not have been paying attention, frankly. And we know that's not the case because they have appeared since the project actually began. And remember, this is a home site. It's a building lot. And Mr. Trainum began with the local Chez Bay Board in 07. There were three hearings there, and the people in this room participated. There were three additional hearings at the local wetlands board, and folks in this room participated. There was a hearing here last month, and people participated. And in that participation, they made references, and you can go look at your record, to the science, and were very careful to introduce themselves to this commission as if they claimed some color of expertise with respect to this matter. And so while I am sympathetic to the fact that they have now determined that that doesn't fly and they need an expert in the likes of Dr. Basco, whom we all know and whom we all respect, I nonetheless must oppose the continuance. The timeline here is such that Mr. Trainum has now been through at least eight different governmental hearings. At every case, less than except the local wetland board, he prevailed. He lost that. He exercised his right to come to you on appeal in that matter, and you all made a decision to reverse that. And we all knew when we left here last month we would be back here today on the Sebaquius hearing under 1205, and that is where we are. We came today prepared to present that matter. The matter, as I've indicated, has been noticed. There's been more than ample opportunity. I think it's safe to say that, while 60 days may not seem like a lot, when a gentleman has been through 2+ years, almost 30 months of dealing with governmental entities, it's time to get him out of that loop. And let's have the hearing, and we'll see what the determination of the commission may be. It is, I suspect, safe to say that when it leaves this room, assuming you decide to have the hearing today, it'll find its way to yet another forum, and Mr. Trainum will be forced to deal with that in that particular circumstance. I think it's pretty clear that no matter what you do and the fact that appeals have been filed and taken on the last month's hearing, the action of the commission has not in any way, shape, or form been stayed to this point. We would, as I began my comments, as a matter of courtesy, I really don't like to be here opposing this, but as a matter of equity on behalf of my client, and the number of months, the duration of time that he spent in this, the number of hearings, and it may be a different story if folks in this room had not participated in every single one of those hearings, I may have a different story. But this morning I'm compelled to ask you, just based on the equities of the circumstance, to allow us to move forward with the hearing which we came prepared to do today. So I thank you for your time.
Questions of counsel? Thank you, Mr. Daniel. Mr. Rowland? Heard testimony from comments by Mr. Daniel and comments also from Mr. Risley. Can you just very briefly refresh me to help me out from a staff's perspective so that I can say that I'm objectively listening to all the arguments from staff's perspective? Can you help me out with the timeline?
We received the joint criminal application on June 10th. We advertised it, or we sent the notice to the paper on July 1st.
What year?
Of 09, pardon me. The Wetlands Board considered the matter at the October 09, the December 09, and then the February 2010 hearings. Came to you on appeal last month. The decision was reversed, and we're back in here today for the abatis. So that we've had it for all 10 months.
And during the course of the previous discussions, matters involving navigation were raised during the course of these various hearings, is that correct?
Correct.
Questions of the commission?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Potts.
Isn't it true that matters of navigation were not relevant in the wetlands case?
That would be correct. Further questions? Mr. Robbins.
Mr. Chairman, also to the timeline, the VIMS report, Randy, if you confirm this, is this the VIMS report in our briefing book is dated 10/3/09?
Yes, that was
that made. Is that the report that went to the Wetlands Board?
Yes, the first hearing was in October of 2010, and I think it preceded the hearing by a few days.
October
2009.
Further questions? On the request for continuance, Mr. Schick?
Even though that the navigation wasn't an issue of germane to the Wetlands Board,
right,
they were fully prepared in arguing that point this entire time. It wasn't until that they realized that they were going to have to go to court that they wanted to get additional ammunition to fight this. So, I think that there's been plenty of time to address this issue on both sides as far as this hearing goes today.
Matters before the commission as far as the continuance is concerned. I Mr. Fox?
Mr. Chairman, I feel that both parties are entitled to legal representation, and the protestants have just hired a lawyer. I understand that maybe they should have hired the lawyer earlier. But I would be inclined to give them some additional time. I would not be inclined to give them as much as 60 days. 30 days would be more in my thinking. I'm interested in what other members of the commission would think.
Is there a second to the motion? Is there a second to the motion? Motion fails for lack of second. The chair will entertain another motion. Mr. Robbins.
Mr. Chairman, I would move to deny the request and hear the case today.
Is there a second to the motion?
No.
Second by Mr. Schick. Further discussion? Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think with staff having laid out the timeline on this case, certainly, and just looking back through the briefing book, staff has indicated that the overwhelming majority of the protestants have been involved in the process throughout the Wetlands Board process, essentially since this JPA was submitted and put through the process. So I think there's been ample time to rebut what is essentially a recommendation from them that dates back to 10309. That's essentially just over 6 months. So I think there's been significant time for the opposition to rebut that information. And I think at some point we do have to consider the rights of the applicant as well. And I think that would be compromised if we were to further delay a process that's already taken a very long time. So I would support the motion.
Further discussion on the motion? All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? One no. Motion to deny request carries. The matter will proceed. Thank you, gentlemen. Crowan.
Morning.
Good morning, sir.
Trinum is requesting authorization to construct a riprap sill and break for a shoreline stabilization project. This property in York County, the project is protested by multiple property owners. For Mr. Fox and the rest of you, this matter was before you last month with respect to the Wetlands Board appeal, where the commission reversed the Wetland Board's denial of this project, finding that their decision was arbitrary, that it was unsupported by the evidence on the record, and that the anticipated public-private benefits outweighed the anticipated public-private detriments. The project is located at 102 Creek Circle.
Hold on a second. Can we cut the volume up a little bit, Kathy? Is that possible? See what we can do. Seems to me as if it's gone down in the last couple months. I don't know.
She just made it a jump.
Okay. Will it go up anymore, Linda?
I have it turned up. We're calling the speaker.
It's what, ma'am?
Time to call the speaker back. But I have turned
off
tonight.
Okay. You proceed volumetrically. Try to get that better in. Thank you.
The project is located at 102 Creek Circle in the Seaford area of York County, more specifically in the York Point subdivision. York Point is formed sits at the confluence of Cabin Creek, Chisholm Creek, the Coast and River. These waterways drain into the Chesapeake Bay, and you'll note we're just a little bit south of the mouth of the York River. More specifically, Mr. Tranum's property sits at the confluence of Cabin Creek and the Coast and River. Property is a vacant lot. This is the property here. You see the man-made canal bordering to the east, Coast and River to the south, Cabin Creek to the north. It's an aerial photograph taken about a year ago. The entirety of the property used to be a marsh. It was filled in by a previous property owner up until the 70s when the Corps of Engineers stopped that illegal fill. And that particular property owner was required to remove a portion of the fill, and this is why you see a marsh and creeks or a gut in the southern reach of the property. This is the York Point subdivision, which also had its beginnings as marsh. Mr. Tranum's property would be in this area here. This is the York Point subdivision. It was all a marsh and creek system. In the early 60s, they cut three canals through the marsh, sidecast the material to create the buildable sites. So this entire subdivision is low and subject to coastal flooding. The ground shot of Mr. Tranum's shoreline. All the construction material debris that was used to fill the site years past, pretty much spilling out of the banks. You've got concrete, bricks, asphalt, metal pipes. The unconsolidated nature of this fill material, the lack of filter fabric, and the overall just inappropriateness of this type of material for shoreline treatment has resulted in the chronic erosion of the shoreline. There are voids behind these structures. The erosion, this is the Cabin Creek side. It's a little bit more pronounced from an erosion standpoint. On the Coast and River side, you have greater fetch conditions, higher wind and tide. Mr. Trainum, to address this erosion problem, hired the design firm of EHB. He's working with Mr. Neville Reynolds, who's the agent for the project. The design that they brought forward, two breakwaters, one here and here, backfill with clean sand planted with tidal wetlands vegetation and dune and backshore plantings. When you move into Cabin Creek, the design breaks or steps down to sills, 1, 2, and 3. The sills will be backfilled with clean sand and planted with marsh vegetation. There is a revetment here. The bathymetry here is fairly deep, so the revetment was a better choice there. There's a rock spur at the terminal end of things to anchor the nourishment material and to protect the canal mouth, which is here. They're also going to rework the existing revetment in the canal, but we have no jurisdiction in that man-made canal. This design was preceded by site visits with the agent with Virginia Shoreline Erosion Advisory Service, with the VEM Shoreline Studies Program, and with a representative from the York County Wetlands Board. Mr. Reynolds testified at the hearing at the Wetland Board that he had met with these people and that they all encouraged the living shoreline design. This is an example of what we call a hybrid living shoreline. Each of the structures will be backfilled with sand, as I said, and then planted with the appropriate vegetation. This is the Pocosin River shoreline portion. This is about +6 elevation. You can see during one of Norida was this particular storm that you see the rack tide. So there was water getting up to the top of the property. So the proposed nourishment behind the structures will come up to that elevation. And where that storm got to the top of the bank, you can see that there was erosion along the top of the bank. Mr. Reynolds stated that the project will replace the existing construction debris shoreline with an engineered shore protection plan based on a living shoreline design. He did show these slides at the past wetland hearings showing what a breakwater would look like if it was planted, a sill, and compared and contrasted that to your more conventional riprap armor. You see you'll have a natural edge with the breakwater project, the marsh behind the sill, and typically with the revetment you get the stark rock face with no vegetation in front of it and just your upland grasses coming down to the top. The protestants have argued from day one that the concern is that the nourishment material behind the breakwaters and the sills will escape those systems and eventually shoal in the canals, canal mouth, the channel in the Cosin River, and up into Cabin Creek. They have argued that the erosion on the property is either not evident or minimal, and they've also challenged the storm wave climate analysis that was prepared by VHB. Basically, have argued that the types of waves that they think will hit the property aren't as large as what BHP has maintained. Both C's and VEMs have a different take on it. The C's, Shoreline Erosion Advisory Services, in their May 2009 letter, and that's in your packet, have indicated that the existing broken concrete revetment is failing and needs to be replaced. Both C's and VEMs have argued that have documented that erosion on the property is evident. And VEMs concluded that the offshore breakwater with beach nourishment for the Pocosin River shoreline is consistent with the preferred approach for moderate to high energy sandy shorelines. I'll leave that arrow up for now. I have a couple more slides I will show you, but I'm going to move into my summary, which is a bit lengthy. In this case, it appears that either a breakwater or sill structure is an appropriate shoreline treatment for the Pocosin River shoreline portion of the Trainum property, based on the comments from C's and from VEMS. To further examine the design elements of these structures, however, and their potential to negatively impact navigation, staff sought additional input from Scott Hardaway from the VEM Shoreline Studies Program. Mr. Hardaway cautions that reducing the offshore location of the proposed breakwater will steepen the backshore slope
and potentially create an unstable design that will leave the uplands susceptible to erosion. He further advised that the Trainham shoreline must be nourished artificially for the structure to work effectively. In fact, the spur portion of the project is included in the design to prevent movement of the sand along the shoreline and into the nearby channels. Mr. Hardaway believes that this structure will more evenly disperse the wave energy of reflection generated from a southeasterly wind along its length. The existing revetment, which is distanced out of the canal mouth, conversely allows for a more focused and closer wave strike at the canal mouth, increasing the potential for bottom scour. A review of the available aerial photography documents the ongoing shoaling of the canal entrance, which you can see here. So it's shoaling today. Based on various FIMS reports, beaches and marshes that are constructed behind these breakwaters or sills function by intercepting and dissipating waves prior to reaching the shore and by placing a physical distance between the water and the upland. Although breakwater systems are designed to create stable beaches and allow for the establishment of marsh grasses, their effectiveness is diminished if they are built smaller than needed for the shoreline's wave climate. Design criteria based on linear relationships between the breakwater's lengths, gaps, and the shorelines established behind these structures have been established based on 30 years of empirical observations of similar structures that are constructed and functioning in the Chesapeake Bay or its tributaries. Although a breakwater system results in a loss of nearshore bottom, the protection the structure provides may ultimately create an extensive intertidal and marsh habitat that offsets those initial losses. The resulting shoreline established behind these structures stabilizes the shore and creates a viable vegetated fringe that restores and or sustains natural resources, provides essential habitat, and creates a beneficial water quality buffer. In contrast, the bulk is in revetments. Living shorelines appear to offer a vegetated coastal buffer zone that is equally effective in controlling shore erosion where the wind, wave, and offshore contours support them. UMRC's Sebacus guidelines also recommend that breakwaters be designed by professionals in such a manner that they do not create adverse sediment transport patterns and are not breached by tides or subject to failure under normal wind, tide, and current conditions. Given the support of both VIMS's Center for Coastal Resources Management and their Shoreline Studies program, it appears that these conditions have been met. We would point out that a sill alternative, and we have a slide of that, sill alternative similar to that presented to the Wetlands Board at their February 11, 2010 hearing will reduce the project footprint on Sebacus lands. Based on the dimensions included in this agent's conceptual drawing, the sill would extend approximately 87 feet from the existing bank, while the most channel encroachment of the breakwater would be 140 feet. Although it is anticipated that a sill at this location could effectively address the existing erosion problems, other than a reduction in the amount of sand fill nourishment, there is no specific evidence that the sill's potential to adversely impact existing channels is any less than that of the proposed breakwater. Quarterly, in light of the acknowledged public and private benefits, the lack of any quantifiable public and private detriments, the comments of C's and VIMS, and after evaluating the merits of the project against the concerns expressed by those in opposition to the project, and after considering all the factors contained in Section 28.2.1205A of the Code of Virginia, staff recommends approval of the project as proposed. Questions of Mr. Owen by members of the commission? Mr. Tankard.
When you speak of a review of available photography documenting the ongoing shoaling of the canal entrance, could you tell us a little bit about that? What the review in your case?
Well, I know. I'm sorry. I know that the agent had met with Scott Hardaway of the Bend Shoreline Studies Program, and that review is documented in the application, where they looked at the little drift and the movement of the sand and where they believe the direction is coming from. And so that has been documented, you know, by the agent in the application. You know, I had this particular slide to show that the canal mouth is currently shoaling. I believe it might be prudent, you know, if you need an expansion of that answer, to hear from the agent. And or perhaps Mr. Hardaway, who retains the archives of the historical areas.
Further questions from Mr. Schick?
You sought the input from Mr. Hardaway since our last meeting?
Correct.
Yeah, okay. So this is...
Yes, we met with him after.
This is new information.
Okay. Correct.
Does he have a written report?
Mr. Fox.
In the document?
No, sir. He does not.
Further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Darling.
Mr. Daniel?
Good morning once again. Still John Daniel. Appreciate you all hearing this morning. You will recall that last month you heard an appeal on the York County Wetland Board decision, and you ultimately reversed that decision. We're here today to seek your support in the issue of the necessary permit from the agency to construct the project that Mr. Trainum advertised in his joint permit application and which was noticed. And that project consists of breakwaters, beach nourishment, sill and wetland terraining, revetment, and replacing broken concrete rubble with state-of-the-art riprap. Mr. Trainum is traveling this morning on business out of the country. However, he is represented by his son, Brent, in the event that the commission has questions of a family member, and he is authorized to speak in that regard. Also present is Mr. Neville Reynolds, senior project manager with BHB. You heard from Mr. Reynolds last month on the design and the effectiveness of the Living Shoreline proposed, and he is present once again to share his expertise and to respond to any remaining questions you may have in that regard. Also, as was noted a moment ago, Mr. Scott Hardaway with VIMS is present. There have been additional discussions since last month with Mr. Hardaway, and he, as your science advisor, is here to speak independently and objectively with respect to the design and scope of the project. The primary purpose of this living shoreline is to protect Mr. Trainum's residential property, which he's clearly entitled to do. As most of you know and realize, the establishment of living shorelines are growing as the appropriate response to protecting one's private property. Historically, as our understanding of the natural marine environment has progressed, so has our best thinking as to how best to proceed with respect to shoreline protection. State agencies, yours among them, expend significant resources, both human and financial, developing science and advocating the use of living shorelines. Agencies proactively, as referenced by the remarks and report from SEAS, assist those fortunate enough to reside on the waterfront to appreciate and understand how to establish this precise type of protection that Mr. Trainum proposes in the application before you. And I think it's doubtful that anyone can say that advances in engineering and design have not proven a substantial positive as we've progressed. We've moved from railroad tie bulkheads to other types of solid bulkheads, to broken concrete, to modern-day riprap, and now to living shorelines. In each transition, the experts and the designers have figured ways to more closely resemble the work of Mother Nature in the use of authorized protections for shoreline property. The entire area shown in Randy's slide and in the vicinity of Mr. Trainum's property has been, over time, severely manipulated, including the properties of those who protest Mr. Trainum's desire to protect his shoreline. Think about it. The entire area where the protestants dwell is filled. It was once mudflat, and it was once wetland, and the construction of the canals themselves, which do now provide and allow the neighbors to enjoy a waterfront amenity, were created to provide the fill necessary to create building sites. The protestants or their predecessors in interest took extraordinary steps to manipulate the area and to create and to protect their current home sites. And there's no question but that they did so using the best management practices of the era. Yet now, they protest the actions of Mr. Trainum to protect his residential home site to the fullest using the best management practices that we know today. So I want to touch on just a few of the compelling points before I ask Mr. Reynolds to review the project and to respond to your technical questions. First, we concur with the perspective of the Department of Conservation and Recreation and Seas Program, which advocates and supports the design of this project as the appropriate shoreline protection. Likewise, we concur with the recommendations of your scientific advisor, the Virginia Institute of Marine Science, which supports the design of the project as the appropriate shoreline protection. We concur with the position of the Corps of Engineers, which is indicated in writing that the project meets the criteria outlined for the Regional 19 permit. And perhaps most importantly, we concur with the recommendation of your staff, who, after a long and thorough review, participate in each and every forum where the matter has been discussed, recommend that the project should be approved as presented as the appropriate shoreline protection mechanism. And just to reiterate that position, in light of this is what your staff report says, in light of the acknowledged public and private benefits, the lack of any quantifiable public and private detriment, the comments of SEAS, the comments of VIMS, and after evaluating the merits of the project against the concerns expressed by those in opposition to the project, and after considering all of the factors contained in Section 28.2.1205, staff recommends approval of the project proposed. In short, every single expert or professional who has reviewed this project over the long term, as it has worked its way through state and local regulatory approvals, concur and agree that it's the right project in the right place at the right time. As your staff noted, the project meets the criteria and the elements of 28.2.1205. As you exercise your authority pursuant to that section, you're instructed to be guided by the public trust doctrine and the provisions of Article 9 and Section 1 of our state constitution. In this case, there is no demonstrated adverse impact to the public ownership of the subaqueous bottom. Rather, you have in your record a very clear demonstration of the absence of any negative impact to the public domain by virtue of the project. Similarly, as you consider the other reasonable and permissible uses of state waters and bottom lands, there is no scientific evidence that the project interferes or precludes any other reasonable use, and there is no evidence of negative impact to marine or fishery resources. In the opinion of each and every professional, including representatives of SEAS, VIMS, VHB, your own staff, indicates there is no scientifically supported basis to determine a negative impact on adjacent or nearby properties. In reviewing the project as part of the JPA application, the Department of Environmental Quality determined there were no negative impacts to water quality. Similarly, the project does not affect in any way submerged aquatic vegetation, as determined by your staff and VIMS. So in conclusion, the project meets the criteria enumerated in 1205, and it is the preferred technique to support the living shoreline. The project is supported by each and every objective professional entity or expert that has examined it for any significant duration. Additionally, every federal, state, local agency, less the local wetland board, which this commission reversed, has granted approval. The project is supported and recommended by your staff. We concur with those recommendations and respectfully request that you issue the permit, which is under consideration today. I would like, if it's all right, Mr. Chairman, for you to hear briefly from Mr. Reynolds and perhaps Mr. Hardaway, if members of the commission have questions of VIMS. Before I do that, I'll be pleased to answer any questions that you may have of me before I take my seat.
Any questions of counsel by members of the commission? Who will you have next, Mr. Daniel?
Mr. Neville Reynolds.
Reynolds? Reynolds, you previously sworn this morning? Raise your right hand. You solemnly swear the testimony that you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So state your name for the record, please.
Neville Reynolds.
Proceed, please.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I've got several images that I'd like to show the board to focus in on some of the key points of this project. Randy's touched on several of those points, so I'm going to scan through many of the images very quickly and get right to the key elements of the project.
For the record, Mr. Rowe, what's your background?
I'm a coastal geologist. I have a master's degree in coastal oceanography from Old Dominion University.
Thank you.
Randy's done a good job at describing the project, series of breakwaters and sills. I wanted to show a couple of examples of what we're trying to achieve here at the project site. This is an example of King's Mill that was permitted by this commission many years ago. I bring it up to, there's been some discussion about the idea that this project is trying to create a recreational beach. I wanted to show some images to depict the shoreline interface that we're actually trying to establish with this project. You can see the dense vegetation that's on the shoreline here. That's what we hope to establish with the project site. These are just more examples. King's Mill, this is on the York River, also at Fox Creek, also permitted by the commission. You can see the dense vegetation that becomes established within the sand fill that's put on here. It's very effective in controlling sand loss from the systems. Another example, this shows the transition from the pre-existing shoreline. You see the second photo depicts the beach fill in place with the breakwaters, and then several years later, the dense vegetation that is established in the back shore, which, as I mentioned, is very effective. In addition to the effect of the structures on the wave approach, the vegetation is very effective in holding the vegetation. Here's the still picture that Randy showed. This is a list of projects that I've personally worked on around Chesapeake Bay. The starred items in red are all projects that were permitted by the commission and the local wetlands board. Several of these projects have been before the commission for numerous phases over the years. After the page two approvals this morning, we could add the BIMS project to this list. There's 35 projects on here, 19 of which have been approved by the commission. This is a navigational chart depicting the project site. I wanted to point out that the primary fetch that we are designing for is a 2-mile fetch down the Coast and River. This fetch is to the southwest. The concern condition is not the day-to-day condition, as has been discussed in the past, but potential hurricane condition that could make its way in this direction and approach the project site over that 2-mile fetch. I'll skip through these photos. Randy's hit that pretty well. I would like to address Mr. Tankard's question about some of the shoaling. I think one of the interesting things about these photos, see the pre-existing shoreline was a continuous eroding marsh system with some sand beaches and sand pockets scattered along the shoreline. The York Point development project served to drastically segment this shoreline and harden the shoreline.
Real quickly, I think for the record also it's important to note the first picture that was exhibited was of 1953. This next picture that shows the canals being dug was from 1963, if that date's accurate, for the record.
Yes. And what's of particular interest, obviously these channels have just been dredged, so I'll go to the next photo, which is a 1994 image. And what was particularly of interest to us is looking at the mouth of these canals and looking for any evidence of significant sediment transport in this direction or in this direction, which would be moving into these canals. As you can see, there's little evidence of that. You do see some subtle shoaling in here. It's very likely a result of actually degradation of this fill material, erosion of this fill material into the channel. Similar with the next image. I want to get to the key points that I wanted to make. This is an image from a document that we've used. This is a document, Shoreline Management in Chesapeake Bay, prepared by Hardaway and Byrne. Some of you folks, Dr. McConaughey, may not consider this high science, but I would like to say that this is the culmination of probably 20 years of research and monitoring of shoreline systems around Chesapeake Bay, both in Maryland and Virginia, and provides a very excellent technical summary of the key parameters of design. A couple of things that I want to point out in this case that are relevant to this project: the beach width in the back shore, the positions of the breakwater structures, this distance, the maximum bay gap distance, the gap between the structures. And these are particularly relevant, as I'll point out in a minute. If you review these parameters with respect to our current design, the distance of the maximum bay indentation here is 85 feet. The gap is at 80 feet. In this case, the gap is 70 feet. The indentation distance is 70 feet as well. This equals a ratio of gap to bay depth of one. Documentation in these, the literature indicates that a relationship of 1 to 1.65 is stable. I bring this up because this is a closed system. Because of the concerns in the area, we have placed the breakwaters closer together. This is a conservative design to limit sand loss from the system, when in fact 1.65 to 1 is documented as stable embayment. Again, Randy did a good job of going through the cross sections. The key point here are the gradual slopes that are in these systems, 10-to-1 slopes on the beach faces, and in the back shore areas, documentation for this being stable beach planforms and beach cross sections is also found in various literature sources. Speaking to the scale of this project and the appropriateness of this design, I've pulled several of the key design parameters from this document, and the script in yellow are the parameters for the Trainum project that we have designed. The script in green are the recommended parameters from this document and other places in the literature. The fetch at this site is 2 miles. That is considered to be a medium energy shoreline, which would be between 1 and 5 miles. The beach width on the Trainum project is 40 feet. The recommended minimum beach width for protection within Chesapeake Bay and the Tribs is 35 to 45 feet wide. The breakwater crest height is 2.75 feet above mean high water. The recommended crest height for breakwater systems in Chesapeake Bay and its Tribs is 2 to 3 feet above mean high water. The breakwater crest length is 100 feet. Recommended crest length, 60 to 150 feet. The bay depth to gap ratio on our project is 1.1. The recommended stable beach planforms is 1 to 1.65. Again, this is a conservative design. And the rock size is 1,000 to 2,500 pounds is what we're proposing. The recommended minimum is 800 to 2,000 pounds. I think you can see that we're consistent with the state of the practice as far as design of breakwater systems go. So to summarize, as has been discussed numerous times, we had a lot of discussions with regulatory agencies knowing that this project was going to be controversial. We went through 3 public hearings on this project before the county and the Bay Board, so it was no surprise that this project was going to be contested. The living shoreline approach was encouraged by all the agencies during pre-application meetings. The configuration and the scale is consistent with the state of the practice and documented successful design parameters around Chesapeake Bay in Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, and North Carolina. The potential for sand loss is minimal due to the gradual slopes in the system, due to coarse sand, use of coarse sand in the beach faces, and due to the low indentation ratio. That is the gap to bay depth ratio that I spoke about earlier. It's a conservative design. The scale does provide a high level of protection and is appropriate for the site. We don't want to, again, there was reference to this being sold as a minimalist design. It's not. It is designed to protect the shoreline. It's designed to be sustainable after storm events so that the beach and the backshore vegetated areas remain in place. The environmental benefits of this type of system have been well documented over the years. With those thoughts in mind, as Mr. Daniel said, we respectfully request approval of the project.
Any questions, Mr. Miller? Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did have one question. During the staff presentation, there was some discussion of an alternative proposal that was at least put forward in a conceptual sense at one of the previous hearings of the Wetlands Board. And how would you characterize the level of protection that would afford to the shoreline versus the project that's proposed here today? Is there a significant difference between the sill approach that was the alternative?
I would say the dynamic of the shoaling effect for the different systems between a breakwater and sill is different. We feel more comfortable with pocket beaches in this location. My concern with the sill would be the stability in the back shore where the elevation starts to rise from about 0.3 up to 0.6, and the ability of the sill in the marsh, particularly during the early stages of its growth, to be able to protect against a major storm event there. I do think that a sill could be effective there, but we don't feel like it's the best approach and we are not proposing it, did not propose it at the Wetlands Board hearing, but just use it as an example.
Thank you. Further questions of Mr. Reynolds? Thank you, Mr. Reynolds. Mr. Daniel, do you have anyone else?
No, sir, Mr. Chairman. I'll reserve a few minutes to come back on rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Richley? I guess I should ask real fast. Anyone else in here in support of the project? In support of the project? Raise your right hand. Solemnly swear. I'll be right with you, Mr. Richland. Solemnly swear the testimony that you give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Set state your name, please, for the record.
Frank Brandon. Scott Frank's son.
And I presume you're just here in support of the project.
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Richland.
Thank you, Mr. Brandon. Once again, Scott Richley with Patton, Warren, Patton, and Diamondstein, here on behalf of several other protestants. As a preliminary note, just on the record, I have no choice but to attempt to proceed today. I do want to note on the record, once again, my objection to requiring me to do so, and note that I think it significantly hampers my ability to effectively represent my clients, present information that I feel that they're entitled to present. That being said,
your objection is so noted.
Thank you, sir. That being said, I'll certainly do the best that I can under the circumstances. The real issue here is the question as to the effects of the project and how it's going to benefit the applicant versus the potential negative effects to my clients. Under Section 18.2-1205 of the Code of Virginia, in determining whether to approve a permit for state-owned subaqueous lands, it says the commission shall consider the public and private benefits of the proposed project and shall exercise its authority under this section, consistent with the public trust doctrine as defined by the common laws of the Commonwealth and adopted by Section 1-200, in order to protect the public rights to use and enjoyment of the subaqueous lands of the Commonwealth held in trust for the benefit of the people, as conferred by the public trust doctrine and the Constitution of Virginia. It goes on from that point to note several additional factors that the Commission should consider, two of which I want to mention is other reasonable and permissible uses of the state waters and state-owned bottomlands, and number four, adjacent and nearby properties. The issues that I really want to focus on are the two enumerated sections from the Code, which are subparts 1 and 4, in addition to the public trust doctrine. I understand that there's been significant scientific study presented on behalf of the applicant, and once again, we don't have the opportunity to refute that today, but there's a couple of things I'd like to point out about their analysis.
And I'd like to emphasize that my clients are the people who live there. They're the ones who are using this waterway every day, and certainly under the public trust doctrine, or certainly some of the factors, and adjacent property owners are certainly some of the people that you should be considering in making this decision. And I understand that the applicant, Mr. Trainum, has a right to protect his property, and my clients do not dispute that he has the right to protect his property. The question is he doing it in such a way that it's optimal in terms of weighing and balancing what he wants to do and the benefits to him versus the potential negative detrimental effects to all of my clients. My clients, a lot of them, regularly use this waterway. They live on the water, on the boat, and they have legitimate concerns about the navigation and ability for them to continue to use that waterway. And I want to emphasize this, because they've emphasized this to me. They're not opposed to the concept of environmentally sound practices and in fact, applaud those efforts. Their feeling on this is that there are less significant intrusive means to do this, where still wetlands can be created, where we still approach a more natural design that doesn't have to be so massive as the design that's proposed. One thing that I think that everybody's looked at this entire area recognizes is this is a highly volatile area. If you look at this, if you look at that site as it comes down the coast, you can see how historically this point of land is formed over probably thousands of years. It comes down to a point, comes down the beach and wraps around. And you have a confluence of different currents coming in, different winds, all in this one point of land, so there's a lot of volatility. One of their concerns, it's not just potential loss of the sand that you put in there. If you create this large structure sticking further out into the bay, how is that going to potentially impact these flows? There was another project that was approved two canals over, which has been referenced in the prior hearings. And yes, there has been some success in that application because it has, by putting the spur out, prevented some of that wraparound sand from coming out. But one of the negative effects was the adjoining landowner had about 30 foot of shoreline that eroded in a matter of a couple of months. And he had to take very quick action to prevent a large loss of his property. The concern is that the same type of thing could happen here. Now, I understand the applicant has said, they have said, look, we've done 60 of these projects before in other locations, and here's the design criteria, and here's why the design criteria is sound, and we're following the design criteria. My real concern stems, though, from their lack of study of this particular site. I have yet to see any depth soundings, any analysis of the bottom lands. I've seen a few aerials documenting shoaling over gaps of 15 years, but I see very little analysis of this particular site and how this design might impact the surroundings. And the report that I got from Mr. Ellen that provides the commission, it does provide just towards the end of his recommendations. We would point out, however, that a sill alternative similar to that presented to the Wetlands Board on the February 11, 2010 hearing will reduce the project's footprint on subaqueous lands. It goes on to say, although it was anticipated that a sill at this location could effectively address the existing erosion problems, other than a reduction in the amount of sand fill nourishment, there is no specific evidence that a sill's potential to adversely impact existing navigable channels is any less than the proposed breakwater. In essence, what I'm reading this is, from what we can tell, either of these alternatives will work, and the protestants have failed to demonstrate that the one that's being promoted is worse than the one that the other alternative. And I would submit to the commission, why is the burden on the protestants to prove that to you? Why shouldn't the burden be on the applicant to prove to you that the approach, the more significant massive approach, is not a better approach? You're required to prove an inverse, but yet we don't have the ability to bring in somebody to do that. And I would point out that I think that the applicant should be required to go back and analyze these alternatives, look at the site specifically, more specifically the soundings, look at the bottom depths, and do some analysis and prove to the commission that we're not going to have negative impacts on the canals over the years. Just a couple of few points, and I will be brief. I recognize the commission has a lot of people here. Yeah. if you look at the other revetments that are out there for the other canals that are down there, they have held up exceptionally well over the last year. I actually went out in a boat just last week with Dr. Basco, and went down and looked at all those revetments. And once again, I think it supports that there may be less significant, less massive approaches that very well may suffice, once again, without causing the negative impact that this project could result in. And once again, I would note that Mr. Van Landingham's letter from Conservation and Recreation seems to agree also that either of these approaches would work. I'm just going to wrap up and say some of the protestants also would like to voice some additional concerns. They are a big part of who the people you are looking out for as the commissioners up here. I'd ask you to seriously consider their views and their concerns in making your decision. I respect the board and each of you, your position with the board. Citizens boards have great authority and great importance in the Commonwealth of Virginia. I totally respect what you do and what this board does. And I think that, you know, it's imperative that you consider the people that you're representing here, all these people that took their day off of work to come up here and express their concerns. And they are the ones who are located right at the project. I have asked each of them to try not to be repetitive, number one, also be brief, because once again, we're mindful and want to be respectful of the number of matters you have to hear today. But some of them want some additional points they'd like to raise, and that's all I have for the commission. Thank you.
Questions, Mr. Richley? I guess just one quick point. That I guess basically hinged on the burden of proof as to who should be responsible, who should not be responsible, and how that gauge should be made. I think the Code of Virginia is very, very clear in Section 28.2.1100 that mandates that the Virginia Institute of Marine Science shall be our scientific advisor. For us to deviate from that as a commission and then proceed down another path as far as the determination from burden of proof, who's right, who's wrong, I think is almost an abrogation of our responsibility. So I just want to get that on the record and let you know that we really, really rely significantly on the advice that we receive from the Virginia Institute of Marine Science. Do we always adhere to it? It would be unfair to tell you that no, we don't always in totality adhere to it, but for the most part, I think that's the foundation that we base our decisions upon as we go down the path, and I think that's mandated by the Code of Virginia, and I think that's what we have in this instant case here. So I just want to set that on the record for you.
I appreciate that, and I understand the Commission's point on that. I would like to say, once again, our intent was, when we had our expert involved, was to communicate with them and actively get involved with them with the hope that they might change their position when we came back here, but once again, we didn't have that opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Grizzly. Are you going to go ahead and basically direct who's to be coming up next, or you just want me to go ahead like I normally do?
I think it's fine.
That'd be fine, sir. Thank you, Counselor. Who would like to be heard in opposition to this matter? What I'd like to do, if I could, please, is all of those that wish to speak in opposition, if you would stand, raise your right hands, and be sworn. And when you come up here, just please state your name for the record. Do you solemnly swear the testimony that you'll give today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth to help you guide? Thank you.
What this slide thing for me?
Sure. Which one do you want to say?
The one in the flag that showed me.
My name is Chad Green. I represent the property owners at 401 Wildy Road. Now, 401 Wildy Road, when you look at the street map, is not adjacent to this project. But when you look at the aerial map, it is.
Let's go ahead and show them the one you want. Did you use these arrows to go back and forth? Here's your corner, Chad. Great.
Right there where you see the site, the property owners that I represent own this parcel of property right there, which is directly next door, as you can see. The first time we were given notice of this project was about 14 days ago when one of the residents from York Point came down and spoke to us and said, hey, there's a project going on here. The owners of this property had no prior knowledge. And I would ask you to consider that and consider tabling this matter until proper notice can be given to the adjacent property owners. Also, One of the concerns with the project property owners have, okay, right here is the project, right there is the property of the property owners that I represent. Right there you see a little flag on that point. There was concern that materials being placed there would migrate over to there, and there's a little channel, a small oyster cove, and silt in that cove. And we would like to hear more science of that. So those were the objections. I had heard some issues that there was somehow that we were under the gun for a 10-month from the time the project starts to the time it's completed. I've been working on a project with Chip in Gloucester for a gazebo on the end of a pier, and we've been working on that for a year and a half. So I think I would urge the commission to take the time, get it right. If we have to come back down next month, then we have to get the proper notice being taken care of with adjacent property owners over there, and we have to get some additional science. Let's do it. The council for the opposing side had mentioned that science changes, that best management practices change. He mentioned that at one time railroad ties were an acceptable shoreline stabilization project. Well, let's go ahead, take the time, and get this right. And that's all I have to say, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next.
Good morning, gentlemen. Eric Ancaro, 112 Creek Circle, my residence for the last 7 years, and the 23 prior to that was 110 Creek Circle. So I'm going to try to stick to the facts here. I want to first make sure everybody knows that none of us are protecting this gentleman's right to protect his land. That benefits everybody in the community for him to get it as stabilized as possible. And I want to also emphasize that we like the living shoreline approach. We like what's been being done on the Cabin Creek side with the more conservative sill approach. We also note that that's very prevalent up and down the Coastal River, up and down Chisholm Creek, both of which experience very similar exposures, very similar wave, wind, action, etc. So we do feel that that is a very appropriate approach to erosion control in this area. And quite honestly, we met with Mr. Van Landingham last week of the DCR, and he as well mentioned that his initial thought was a nice sill system, but it was the applicant himself who brought up why not a more expansive breakwater project. And you can see that within his letter of advisory that he actually felt that a revetment is appropriate. But nobody in here wants a revetment, I don't believe. That's no longer the science as we were speaking of. I guess, again, we have a smaller turnout today because it is a work day, but we do have about 22, I believe, households that could be adversely affected by this. And all of us struggle really to see how this fits into the VIMS and the VMRC guidelines, which are published, and are derivatives of the Virginia Legislative Code. To actually read the general guidelines within your pamphlet, it almost speaks to no shoreline modification. And obviously, again, we all know that's not appropriate, but it says alteration of the shoreline is not justified when possible adverse effects to other property owners are potential of the proposed activity, which obviously that's why we're all here, when there are viable alternatives which can achieve the given purpose without affecting subaqueous lands such as oyster grounds and other natural resources. Speaking directly to the shoreline protection strategies, and I apologize because I believe at the last meeting I said a lot of the same stuff, but I think it's important, and I think that these guidelines are not being followed with this proposal, unfortunately. With the shoreline protection piece section of your guidelines, it talks over and over about these types of structures in places where there's a clear and definite need to create a beach, or where there's an active and existing supply of sand, and neither one of those accurately describe this parcel. I mean, there's no beach on either side. There's no nearshore sand supply. There's no existing sand there. So I struggle to see how a breakwater, a large breakwater system, to dampen energy, wave energy, is necessary here. And within that context, it speaks of these systems being appropriate where there's active detrimental erosion. And that's not the case here. This land is stabilized. It's reached a point of stabilization over 5 decades. With regard to your filling section in the VMRC code, VMRC guideline, in cases where encroachment beyond mean high water is justified, encroachment should be limited to the minimum required to achieve the goal. I think all of us struggle in seeing how this is minimal, extending 140 feet into public domain, utilizing a 169-foot spur right at the edge of our canal, dumping 6,500 cubic yards, which is, for reference, somewhere between 800 and 1,100 dump trucks of fill dirt. Beyond the mean high water line, I'm not sure how that's minimal, and we struggle to figure that out. Our concerns, for clarification, our concerns aren't just about sand leaving the structure, especially after our meeting last week with Dr. Basco. It's potential shoaling. Mr. Reynolds from VHB said that the canals had maintained themselves very well over the years. They tend to do that when you dredge them. So looking at these aerial pictures doesn't show the entire picture. The entire Cabin Creek Canal was dredged by a resident down Cabin Creek at his own expense. The canal that we were all on was dredged at our own expense. I was a little younger at the time, so it wasn't my personal expense, but certainly my family's expense and all the other residents. So there is tremendous sediment flow in that area. It could potentially pile up. It could shoal up on the outside. We don't know. All we're asking for is a more reasonable approach. Follow the guidelines that you have outlined and the VIMS has created. That's all we're asking for here. We're not asking you to put a revetment in. We're asking you to find a more reasonable approach. It's not needed to control erosion. There's much less invasive living shoreline alternatives, which we are all for. And personally, we're boring all the consequences. Nobody else in this room is. I don't have the financial resources to shoulder these consequences. I don't think the commission here has anything to gain by turning this state land that's used by residents. If you remember from my last presentation, it was a picture of a gentleman fishing out there. The overhead picture we see here even had a gentleman kayaking in it. This is used by state citizens. And I don't think that you guys have anything to gain by turning this state land that's used for crabbing and fishing into personal property, which is essentially what it would become. Basically, all I'm asking you to do is paint this with a conservative brush, which I feel the VMRC typically does, and let's get an appropriate means out there. We tried to approach the applicant and ask that, and it fell on deaf ears. So we're here today asking you guys to please represent us as best you can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair,
yes, sir.
I'd like to expand. You said there is tremendous amount of sand being transported in the system, and it has filled in your channel as the shoreline is protected today. That's correct?
There is. Again, this is not my science. I'm just a dumb accountant. So, but I do believe there's sand coming throughout the entire system in Pecosin River and Chisholm Creek. There's certainly some coming down around from the bayside. Directly across from my house, there's substantial shoaling in. And again, I believe it to be coming from outside. And I want to actually comment on this picture to your point. In years past, this was very pocked mud. You could step in it and it would sink down to here. And it we were out there the other day, and it appears that it's taken on a combination of mud and some sand filling on top. So there is silt flow, and it could potentially...
So you're saying, from your observation, that this area is actually trapping some of the material presently, and this mud flat is turning to be more solid.
I think it may, and that's
also trapping into the canal where you live.
And trapping in the canal, certainly. Yes, sir.
Who's next?
My name is Frank Ancaro, and I live at 110 Creek Circle. I'm one of the ones right there on the canal side, close to the end. Just let me start off by saying I'm a little bit unprepared. I'd almost assumed, maybe that was wrong, that we would get a continuance. I think in the interest of equity, I really regret the absence of Professor Basco's input. I really think it would have been helpful to all of us in understanding this. There's no question he's an expert in the field. I would also sort of like to address the timeline. I know that was an issue in y'all's decision. This project has had a very relaxed schedule, and it has been so at the owner's direction. A couple examples, and I know the plan was prepared in late 08. It wasn't even submitted to y'all till mid 09. It was heard, and I think it was scheduled and heard as rapidly as could be done. I think he had to stake it out. It caused some delay by the Wetlands Board in October. The November meeting was canceled by the storm. The applicant came in December and for no reason and no explanation asked to table it until the February 11th meeting. That was a two-month delay right there that we would love to have back. And now you all have certainly expeditiously moved it through the process. So, and all along from the October meeting on, the Wetlands Board had sort of steered this thing into a more modest proposal. So in all fairness to the homeowners, it was not reasonable, I don't think, to expect us to incur or even realize that we would need legal counsel and professional technical help until after the March 23rd meeting. So I want to go on record as saying that. And I really don't think another 30 or 60 days would have held up the applicant. Most of the delays, or at least some of the delays, have been on his part. I will go through my what I have prepared or what I can have been able to hastily put together. Since the last meeting, and on behalf of concerned adjacent property owners, which we seem to be in the forefront of representing, we took the initiative to contact and meet with the applicant in the interest of seeing if a compromise could be reached. Although the meeting was amiable and he said he would go back and reconsider alternative plans, subsequent conversation between counsel of each party was less encouraging. But we're definitely here today trying to seek a compromise, a living shoreline that doesn't carry with it the risk that we're concerned about. I'm not going to go into erosion protection. We've argued that. We just feel like the nature of the exposure and the fetch, the shallow waters out there that break the wave heights, everything is in support of the fact that this is not a high erosion area. Randy, would you mind putting back the aerial photograph? I just wish to point out the Mr. Trainum's property, the next piece of property up, and the following piece of property after that. The next two pieces of property have been stabilized for decades with revetments. And that was one of the things I know that Professor Basco noticed. Actually, we have somebody in this room that grew up in one of those houses down there, and he can attest to the fact that the revetment that is in place there has protected those things through all the major storms going back literally decades. So again, I don't want to continue on with arguing the need for this project for erosion protection. But I do want to make, as best I can, one point that I don't think has been adequately addressed. I made note in one of my earlier presentations to the Wetlands Board, of which you should have a record, that I wasn't sure where this project adequately addressed environmental concerns. And I know y'all are here to recognize environmental concerns and the impact on the environment. I know it talks about the areas that would be created but it really doesn't do an analysis of the areas that would be created versus the areas that would be displaced by this project. And one of the arguments the applicant would have you assume is that the project is in the public benefit based on ecological value. And I would argue that this might not be the case. Although the breakwater applications identifies the new areas created, application never addressed the ecological trade-offs of a breakwater system or a breakwater system versus a much less aggressive sill and revetment system, nor does it evaluate damage done to the existing ecosystem. In the absence of anything more definitive or quantitative, I'll offer the following for your consideration. An excellent resource in understanding the ecology associated with these coastal resources is the document titled Wetland Guidelines, prepared by the Virginia Institute of Marine Science and the Virginia Marine Resources Commission. A second resource is the training modules prepared by VIMS and available on their websites, and I assume these are the training modules that are used on their, during their workshops. The first step in understanding the ecology in the area of the proposed breakwater and fill system is to define existing conditions. A couple of weekends ago, we took core samples at fairly frequent intervals and would describe the existing bottom as a mixture of dark sand and mud. At the present time, it is for the most part unvegetated, although I know that in the past it has had significant patches of vegetation. And pictures taken recently as last fall show the bottom to be a higher percentage of mud. In conclusion, the bottom matches the definition of, quote, sand mud mixed flat community, according to VIMS and VMRC definitions. My second step was to define each system included in the proposed project as follows. The stone infrastructure has no ecological definition. The proposed areas of planting is behind the sills, above mean high water, in the area behind both the breakwaters and the sills, matches the definition of vegetated tidal wetlands. The proposed areas immediately behind the breakwaters between mean low water and mean high water is defined as intertidal beach community. These are y'all's definitions. The third step was to rank the ecological benefits of each system as follows. The stone infrastructure has no defined ecological value. The proposed areas of plantings above mean high water in the area behind the breakwaters and sills, the vegetated tidal wetlands, are highly desirable in support of the marine ecosystem. The proposed areas immediately behind the breakwaters between mean low water and mean high water, the intertidal beach community, are considered to be relatively low in primary production and nutrient cycling. The value of an intertidal beach, which is being created by these breakwaters, in y'all's own words, the value of an intertidal beach community is normally associated with and functions in support of dunes and nearshore sandbars, neither one of which exist at this site. The existing sand mud mixed flat community, the existing, what's out there in that photograph that was previously up, is described as having a high habitat value and is high in primary production and nutrient cycling. Also importance, that type of bottom is considered an erosion buffer in that it slows wave velocity. That area extends out quite a ways, and I think we have seen over the decades that it has been effective in reducing wave energy and protecting that area from erosion. My next step was to use the scale drawings included with the application to estimate as accurately as possible the footprints of breakwaters, sills, vegetated areas, and non-vegetated areas of fill, and compare the results of an example system of sills and revetments on the Pecosin River to a system of sills similar to that on the Cabin Creek side. And my conclusions are as follows. Existing erosion at the site is not significant, partially because of the existing sand mud mixed black community is slowing wave action protecting the shoreline. This is a condition that has been observed for decades. Two, the planning area, i.e. the intertidal wetlands, created by both a breakwater system and a sample silt system, are very close to being almost identical areas. By that I mean if you take a silt system similar to what's shown on Cabin Creek, show it on the Pocosin Riverside, there's just about the same amount of vegetated wetlands behind it. So the breakwater system makes no gains there. The breakwater system has a stone footprint approximately 2,500 square feet larger than a silt system would require and replaces that amount of highly desirable sand mud mixed flat community with a footprint of stone which has no defined ecological value, resulting in loss of ecological benefit. Compared to a sill and revetment system, the breakwater system replaces an additional 14,000 square feet, that's a third of an acre, of highly desirable sand mud mixed flat community with a footprint of intertidal beach community, which has significantly less ecological value. The combined environmental cost of the breakwater system to compare to a sill system is to reduce the sand mud flat community by a total of 16,500 square feet while creating intertidal wetlands equal to a sill system. Overall, a sill and revetment system, which preserves much of the existing sand mud mixed flat community, offers the most ecological benefit. I'm going to leave this with y'all today. I was told by Mr. Owen that I could enter this in the record. It includes my capital. Oh, here it is. I didn't prepare slides, but these are my drawings where I've superimposed a sill system. I've established grids for measuring areas, and I have performed some calculations on the areas involved. In all of this talk, I don't honestly feel like this project has really been studied environmentally. It's just been assumed to be good. My position is that a sill system would gain more environmental benefit than this massive structure. I do want to take a few more minutes. I tried to jot down some quick notes, some things that I guess have disturbed me and what have been said here this morning. And I'll have to jump around a little bit. It's been mentioned several times, us as property owners, the so-called people in protest by Mr. Trainum, how we benefit from property that was improperly developed. We regret that. We were not around in the mid-50s when that property was developed. I don't know how we can be held responsible for that. And yet that seems to be a strike against us twice now. The properties that we have are all being replaced with revetment system as time goes on. So there's some improvements being made, but unfortunately it sort of is what it is. Mr. Trainum himself certainly benefits from land that was developed in a way that is certainly not sensitive today. It was talked about best management practices. I put my own seawall in the 1970s. It's due for replacement now. But when I did, I went to all the agencies, and the tongue and groove wood salt-treated, CCA salt-treated wood seawall was best practices. Of course, at the time, we were using railroad ties and concrete asbestos panels and a lot of other things. Who knows what the best practices years from now are going to be. But once this project is in place, it'll be there forever, essentially forever. So I think that's another strong argument for making sure that maybe less is more. I've seen the photographs that have been flashed up here several times. Kings Mill, I think Yorktown has been used, the proposed development of VIMS has even been used. And every time I see those photographs, I have to say to myself, those are long, straight stretches of beach, similar to those conditions that are described in both the Virginia and Maryland websites where breakwater systems are applicable. This is not that application. This is a small area, essentially a small area for this size of construction, sandwiched in on all sides by channels. And if there is any kind of detriment to either side, this could cause damage, as my son has said, we'll be the left ones holding the bag, and there'll absolutely be nobody to turn to and no recourse. I didn't bring it with me. As I mentioned, I didn't think I needed to be prepared for this. I thought Mr. Basco would be representing us from here on out. But what are y'all's slides in the training modules clearly describes the conditions where these breakwater beach nourishment systems are not applicable. And I tried to remember as many as I could. One of them is if a naturally occurring beach does not exist, and that's not the case here. When the purpose is to create a beach, and that's clearly what this purpose is. When navigation is threatened, that's another one of the no-nos. And when the stability of the fill cannot be guaranteed. In every one of the bullets in that slide that address when a breakwater and nourishment system is not applicable, it's referring to the breakwater, the nourishment system, but it's, if you read the slides on either side, it's pretty much pointed at the nourishment system behind the breakwater is intended here. Without a doubt, every of the conditions where it is not appropriate are what we have here. Now I'd like to, without dwelling on it, because it plays into, I guess, the situation we find ourselves, and that's this burden of proof thing. I certainly appreciate, Mr. Chairman, what you said, but yet at the same time, as a result of the last meeting, it was clearly said that the burden of proof was going to be on us to prove that there were risks here. That's why we came away from the meeting and said, we need legal advice, we need professional representation. Up until that March 23rd ruling, we really didn't feel like we did. So to say that this thing has been around for 8 months, a year and a half, however long, is really not fair to us. At this point now, we have incurred legal costs, we have incurred professional costs. Mr. Hardaway Mr. Basco has been to the site. He spent a considerable amount of time there. He asked if we would have if access to a boat could be provided. We did. I wasn't there, but several of the others were. He went up and down all the canals, the entire neighborhood, up Cabin Creek. He did a very, very exhaustive survey of that property, and he'll probably come back. And I really regret that we're not, all of us, everybody in this room, are not going to have the benefit of his input. I think that's a big mistake. One of the things, I'm just reading my scratchy notes here. One of the things that the websites talk about is these systems requiring maintenance. And maintenance, at times, requires the replacement of fill. That tells me that the retention of fill is not guaranteed by these projects. And if it ever leaves that site, it's going in one of three navigable waterways. And then what happens? The owner gets to replace it with more sand, and more sand after that. This is a risk that none of us, and I don't feel like y'all should be bearing. As my son said, we did, Mr. Richley said, we did go up to see Mr. Van Nattingham. We had a very good meeting with him. We went to see him because his letter was included in the application, and it didn't seem to recommend a breakwater system. It talked more about sills, revetments, and sills, and closed with a statement on breakwaters. So I found a hard time reading into that 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 was his recommendation. We also had the pleasure of going up and speaking with Mr. Hardaway, trying to just understand this thing. And you got to realize, we're trying to understand this thing because we're trying to understand if it's good or bad. And so, but so far, we have not been able to understand why this project is good. I hope I've made a point of showing you it's not good environmentally. Just because it creates all this area is not a given that it's the best thing environmentally. We're not sure. We're convinced it's not it's required for erosion protection. And there is risk. Because of those three reasons, I don't see how y'all have any choice but to either turn this project down or ask for it to be re-engineered. I feel like a request for an extension of time was made. We got the letter for this meeting arrived on Saturday. We went around and got everybody's signature on a letter requesting an extension. At that point, it was only 6 days away. And I'm sure y'all are within your guidelines for doing that, but under the circumstances, when you consider the complexity of this site and the amount of concern that has been expressed by the local homeowners, I'm not sure that I feel like that was the proper thing to do. I brought a book with me here, and I would like to enter it into the record.
Please do. Yes, sir.
Okay. It's got, actually, notes and all, I guess a copy of my presentation here today. It's also a pretty complete binder. It might not be everything of everything that followed us through the marine resources, wetlands hearings. I don't think it's anything more than that. I know we were coached last time before the March 23rd meeting that nothing could be brought to the meeting except was on record with the Wetlands Board. So I think I'm pretty careful that it does not include anything more than that. It does include a couple more documents, my presentation today, and that's probably it. But I would like to enter this in record. And I know there was another handout available, the blue handout. I don't know if that's being made a part of this record. I think that's
everything that's been introduced will be part of the record.
Okay,
yes,
can I grab that or grab a copy of that? That's Randy, is that
the
one?
Okay.
But it's not in the record until I asked you to be put in the record. Is that correct?
No, sir. It's in the record. It's always part.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
This might be redundant, but I'd maybe still like you to have it.
So, no. Thank you, Shane Carroll.
Just in closing, it seems like, as we said to the Wetlands Board, and it might have been part of their decision, if an error is made, it seems like it ought to be made on the side of caution. And I'll close with that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. Morning, sir.
Good morning. My name is Anthony DeLuca. I live at 114 Creek Circle.
Yes, sir.
I just have a couple of comments I'd like to make.
Please do. I'm listening well.
Okay. A couple of points that I'm going to make. First is that I want to discuss the risk to our navigable channels. Then I want to discuss the lack of risk mitigation that has been conducted. And that's pretty much all I'm going to go into today. But first I want to start by saying is that I'm not only a protestant. I don't think that's necessarily the best description. I'm a stakeholder. And I think it's important to note that no one else except the homeowners and Mr. Tranum are stakeholders in this matter.
This directly affects my property. It affects my property value. It affects the use of the waterway. So this is very important to me, and I want everyone to understand that there's a direct impact on us. And like Mr. Ancaro said, I think it's important to err on the side of caution because of that fact. Mr. Tranum does want to protect the shoreline. We think that's great, but we would like him to do it in a way that reduces the risk to our property as best as possible. So first, I want to talk about the potential risks to our navigation. I think there are three potential problems that I want to outline. As has been discussed, we are seeing shoaling due to longshore sand transport at this location. I believe that a lot of it is coming from this area here due to some of the problems that we've had in the past. So sand is coming along, and my concern is that this large spur structure that the applicant has proposed will trap that sand and begin increasing the shoaling on the front face of that spur. That's one risk that I see. A second risk I see is increased wave patterns due to changes in the shoreline structure resulting in damage to my pier and my bank. Right now, there is a status quo of how wave events occur. We're creating a very large change, and my concern is that what impact will that have on my property? And I have not seen anything address that issue. And I do believe that the burden is on the applicant to show that his changes are not going to damage my property, and I haven't seen that in the application so far presented. The third risk that I see, and that has already been discussed, is a loss of sand during storm events from the structure. The 1,000 or so dump trucks of fill could leach, and they're likely to go into the two sink points on either side. And which will damage our ability to navigate those channels. So, I wanted to point out two projects that I believe have already been discussed, that have been designed and approved by some of the same experts that are endorsing this project. And I wanted to point out that both have had unintended consequences. The first is the project at Yorktown. There is tremendous sand loss from that structure. And it has to be replenished annually. What evidence, what scientific or engineering data has been presented in this case that will show anything other than that will happen in this example? Secondly is the development that's happened along York Point, the Cashy project. That also has had unintended consequences. The same agencies that approved this structure, and things happened that were not expected. What is to say that something is going to happen that's not expected here? I believe the burden is on the applicant to show that, and I do not believe that that has been shown. I see a lack of scientific and engineering support in the application. I see a lack of scientific and engineering data specific to the site to establish the conditions occur that they're designing for. Specifically, Mr. Reynolds noted that they're designing this structure for a hurricane event. What data has been presented to show the conditions at this site during such a hurricane event that they are designing for? They have presented no data to show that. The only data that I have heard is a reference to a book that Mr. Reynolds has indicated to me that he was sorry he even referenced it, that talked about a 5-foot wave in a 30-knot wind, that I've lived there through those conditions and I haven't seen that. So I'm concerned that we have very little data about the conditions that occur at this site, scientific data. And so when one says that they are designing shoreline erosion control to meet a certain condition, Mr. Reynolds said hurricane conditions, what data does he have showing what those conditions are to even come up with a design? I'd like to point out that Mr. Owen has mentioned several times this is an engineered shoreline erosion control measure. Where is the engineering? I didn't see an engineer's signature on the document. I've seen no engineers referenced in the document. The only source of engineering analysis that I have seen referencing this application comes from the Seas report and the Bend Shoreline report. Mr. Owen said earlier, he said, given the support of both VIMS and the Shoreline Studies Program at VIMS, it appears that the conditions to basically meet the burden have been met. So I wanted to point out that Mr. Owens is making no statement about whether or not this project will affect our navigation and affect our navigability. He is relying solely on the VIMS report and the Seas report. And I would like to go into those two reports because Mr. Daniels would paint a picture like the agencies are all for it. When you go and actually read their documents, it's not the case at all. I'd like to start out with the report, the May 11, 2009 report by Mr. Van Landingham. I wanted to note, and I quote, Mr. Landingham writes, "We recommend a properly designed and constructed riprap structure." That was his first recommendation. Secondly, Mr. Van Landingham recommends, and I'll quote, "To protect the shoreline and enhance the established fringe marsh, you may consider," he doesn't necessarily recommend it, his language says, "you may consider the construction of a riprap marsh sill." Finally, at the end of Mr. Van Landingham's document, he says, and I quote, "During the site visit, we discussed the possible effectiveness of a nearshore breakwater system along the Pocosin River." Mr. Van Landingham never recommended it. Mr. Van Landingham basically says, "We discussed it, and I think it would be okay." Mr. Daniels paints a very different picture. Mr. Daniels presents the picture that Mr. Van Landingham says, "Yes, this is what we want." That's not, if you read this document, that's not what it says. And I think that's important. Secondly, I wanted to address the only other source of scientific and technical information that we have presented, and that comes in the form of the VIMS Shoreline Report of October 3rd. The only instance in that document that I could find in reference to the southern structure says that, and I can't quote because I don't have it in front of me, but it says that the breakwater structure is appropriate for moderate to high energy sandy shorelines. Your scientists have said that the structure proposed is appropriate for moderate to high energy sandy shorelines. But that's not what we have here. So, again, this project is being presented like the agencies approve of it, whereas if you actually read their documentation, that's not the case. I'm trying to get the pocket mud picture back up here. Does that look like a sandy shoreline? Why do we not have a document from Mr. Hardaway? If your scientific advisor is VIMS, where is the document? I have a document from VIMS with one sentence that I can see that talks about this massive, massive breakwater system. Let's get more data. Let's get more science. If we're going to make a decision, let's make a good decision. What's being proposed here is permanent. You know, you can go and look at the old structures, the old, you know, railway tie structures, and they're dilapidated and in poor shape, and they look awful. The same thing could happen here. This is a fad now. What about in 50 years? Let's get some more science, let's get some more data, and let's make a proper decision. I mean, I thought it was very appropriate that Mr. Bowman made the point that VIMS is the VMRC scientific advisor. Where's the report? I read the Shoreline Report of October 3rd. I didn't see a whole lot of data there. And again, their recommendation is that this is appropriate for sandy shorelines. Neither the Seas or the VIMS document did I see address the impacts to our navigable channels. So we have no scientific or engineering support to say that the proposed application, the proposed development, will not affect our channels negatively. I think that's required, and I think this body should note that and deny this application or table it so that we can develop more scientific information. I think it's also important to note that Mr. Van Landingham's number one recommendation was a revetment. Now, I understand that, that's not necessarily the in vogue thing, but a revetment or a sill structure is adequate for shoreline erosion control and does not introduce new unintended consequences to our navigation. So the applicant wants to put in this large breakwater project. The experts have said it's appropriate. It is not their recommendation, contrary to, I think, what the applicant would try to cast in light of. And there are smaller, not as invasive options available that I think should be considered. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bruce.
My name is Mary Loesch. I live at 106 Creek Circle. I'm in opposition to this at this point in time because nobody has convinced me that this is the way to go. And all this stuff that I've read from them and from the gentlemen that the Ankara men have spoken to, it looks like there is a smaller project that could do the same thing. I object to going out 140 feet into a public waterway that we all use.
Thank you. Good afternoon, ma'am.
Good afternoon. I'm Cheryl Collier, 108 Creek Circle, and I'm a stakeholder, and I have major concerns about this project. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Good afternoon, sir.
My name is Robert Buehlhart. I live at 107 Creek Circle. I'm here in support of the opposition because of the magnitude of this project and the potential risk it could bring to the navigational channels at York Point and Cabin Creek, when a simple revetment would protect the shoreline as stated by Mr. Reynolds. Knowing that these revetments have worked for many of the existing neighbors for years, why take the chance on something that is unproven? Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Good afternoon, sir.
Gary Van Tassel. I reside at 102 York Point Drive in Seaford, and although I'm not an adjacent property owner, I do live on York Point. I spoke to you before, and since we're already in the afternoon, I won't spend a lot of time repeating what has already been said. I'll just refresh your memory that I'm a master's degree in ocean engineering, naval architect, professional mariner, and these are some subject matters that I have a degree of expertise. Last time I spoke to you, I talked about the wave energy, which was being touted as being 5-foot waves and 30 knots, and I noticed that that has completely disappeared in the presentation, so obviously I must have prevailed in my presentation with that. What has now shown up is a definition of fetch requiring this as a medium energy, and I would, having gone into the BIMS some of the BIMS documents where that definition of certain fetches of 1 to 5 miles create a medium energy area, as a professional in the area, I would disagree with that. It's a nice rule of thumb, but it doesn't take into account what the immediate upwind land area looks like in terms of sheltering the wind, and it doesn't take into account what the shoal or water depths are, and those have significant effects. Randy, I don't know if you're opaque, does this project opaque stuff? I'll just enter these into, obviously, your one. Okay. I won't attempt to screw your machine up.
Let me do this.
I have a unique ability to do that. To look at, but this was taken, a photo I took of the area, and the just to put the project, also I point in the right direction, this is the project area, This is on the adjacent area off of Creek Circle. Unfortunately, the photo doesn't come through here very well, but this is the kind of winds that they were talking about from the south, and the wave action that can be seen here. You can see it better in the actual photo. This is about 3 weeks ago. We had a series of 3 days of southerly winds, steady 25, gusting past 30, and this was well into a duration of well over 36 to 48 hours of that kind of winds, and this is all the wave action that comes in there. There was also a question here about sand transport, and this is directly behind my house, which is down the first canal, and this has been sand transport in the area. That's steps coming off of my hardened bulkhead, concrete bulkhead. Last year went down three more steps beyond that, and that's been sand transport coming into the canal. So there is a heavy amount of sand transport area, and you can see it all the way up and down that canal. So the documented evidence that there is sand transport. Do you want these?
Yes.
Yes, I am. Thank you very much. Okay. I would just reiterate that I certainly hope that the people that have spoken with experts in support of this project are correct if this project is approved. It is the stakeholders in this, and that will be the ones paying the price if it's not. Because of the degree of sand transport that takes place in that area, I do have concerns about a structure coming that far off the shoreline and interrupting the current patterns and water flows and causing sand to build up in areas that it's unanticipated. We see that all the time. It's a fairly common result of these kinds of things, and when they show up where you don't anticipate it, it becomes a problem for somebody else downstream. So I certainly hope that the people that are in support of this project are correct, because it's going to be the rest of us who will have to pay the price. The simple revetments that have been there on the faces of all of those canals have been there for decades. They've worked. They're stable. They're stable today. They're not moving. They're doing an excellent job of protecting the properties, and quite frankly, I think that the revetment along the Chisholm Creek side of this is perfectly adequate. It protects his property. Nobody denies that he needs, or we would like to see the concrete. I mean, none of us would not like to see that concrete removed. That was, a bad practice when it was done. We didn't necessarily know it, as has been stated, but it should be replaced and renewed with a proper modern revetment. The area along Cabin Creek where the sill is proposed, I think that has great merit, but I am in opposition to imposing potential current shifts and changes on the Pecosin River side or Chisholm Creek side that could have long-term effects. And with that, I'll leave it to you, gentlemen.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Fox has a question.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Fox.
Yes, in your opinion, which way is the sand flowing? Is it flowing from east to west or west to east?
It is, I believe, coming around the point. Your point, and that would be flowing from the canals are almost due north and south, to give you a reference. So it would be flowing from east to west. But I also think that there's a lot of current that comes out of Cabin Creek area. So you've got currents, because that's a pretty large body of water back in there, even though the creek itself doesn't look very big. The marsh area and the water area that's back there that has to move and come through there at tidal changes is pretty significant. So you got water flowing out of that. You got water flowing across. And we're seeing the sand transport coming around the corner. I believe the sand that's coming in our area is coming around York Point. And I don't know whether it's a result of the recent work that was done out there. I certainly understand. I mean, I was out there sandbagging that property owner's property to keep him from losing it a couple of years ago. So, I don't dispute his need to do something. But all of these things have an effect.
Further questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Daniel,
about 5 minutes. try to save you some time. Thank you for the opportunity. Just a couple of points. With respect to this issue of who has the burden, if you will, the burden, I think, is laid out pretty clearly in the legislative enactment 1205. That tells an applicant and instructs this commission what the environmental safeguards should be in considering projects of this nature. There is obviously a difference of opinion. I provided you with my best thoughts as to how the project had met each and every one of those. I think the staff report did the same thing as Randy indicated. When the staff looked at the project in conjunction with the controlling statutory authorization. So I think the burden is the objective burden that's laid out in the statute, and in this case, the applicant has met it. Mr. Richley suggested off the bat here that, you know, we the applicant had all these scientific studies and there needed to be one more. Well, there can always be one more. I understand that. But my point is not that. My point is that we had one. My client, Mr. Trainum, had one expert, one individual that designed this project for him. It was DBH. They did what they thought was best given their expertise and their understanding of the environment in the area and their understanding of the shoreline and what the various and sundry literature and their expertise and experience dictated. Every other entity that looked at this, whether it be C's or whether it be VIMS or whether it be your staff collectively or individually, came to the same conclusion, that it was an appropriate project, that it met the conditions of 1205, and that it ought to be recommended. Now, we can talk about what C said or didn't say, and, you know, we're talking about letters and they from government agency, and they sometimes go all over the place, but the quote in Mr. Van Landingham's letter is, "We've reviewed the proposed plan. It includes breakwaters and protected beach, period. The plan is consistent with our recommendation for effective breakwater design." That's pretty clear. Now, did they make some other comments about sills and revetments? Sure they did. But this is an entity, of course, that works with, I think, still free of charge. They did it one time with shoreline owners to provide their best advice and expertise so that people will undertake these projects in a responsible and demonstrable way. You know, we can argue all day about whether it's massive or whether it's conservative. The experts seem to say it's conservative. I mean, is it big? Yeah. But is it what's adequate to do the job? According to the experts, and not just the expert of Mr. Trainum, but the other independent and objective experts who provided advice to this commission, and which is included in your record. I'm not going to try to answer. I guess I would just conclude with that, you know, there's a lot of, and I guess it can always be true, that when one undertakes a project of any kind, whether it's this project we're discussing today or some other project that may come before you next or later on this afternoon, there's a little bit of that, you know, unknown, I suppose, that's always in the picture. The best we can do is to use the best expertise that we have. But even if, you know, your subaqueous guidelines have factored in that particular point. I mean, if you look at the guidelines that your staff have put forward on subaqueous project, I mean, and I assume that it can be a condition, or it's a condition by virtue of it being the guidelines of the commission. It says any person, firm, corporation constructing or erecting any structure upon or over state-owned bottom submerged lands shall be responsible for the maintenance or removal of such structure upon its abandonment or its failing into a state of disrepair. Now, we heard some comments about, well, maintenance must mean that it's not going to work. It doesn't mean that at all. I mean, nobody would go undertake a project with the assumption that it was going to need maintenance, but in the event that it does, your staff and your guidelines have recognized that. And further, if whether or not how do you get an objective analysis of whether or not maintenance may be needed or not? Well, you just drop down to permit compliance, where it says commission staff conduct compliance inspections on every VMRC authorized project. So authorizing this project, allows Mr. Trainum to go forward, but it doesn't mean that you all have abandoned the project, because your guidelines require you, and your guidelines require Mr. Trainum to maintain this and for your staff to be the objective voice as to when and where what maintenance needs to be undertaken. So I've taken a lot of your time this morning. I appreciate your patience on the case. Clearly, we continue to support the recommendations of your staff and look forward to your deliberations. I thank you.
Questions? Thank you, sir. Thank you both sides for a very good presentation, in-depth presentation. Matters now before the commission for discussion and action.
Jim?
Mr. Fox?
Is it possible to call on Bims to question?
Yes, you can. Which group from Bims would you like to speak with? Mr. Hardaway?
I guess Mr. Hardaway.
Mr. Hardaway? You've been previously sworn, sir, and you are under oath.
Yes, sir.
Direct your attention to Mr. Fox, please.
Yes, sir.
When you looked at the project, you had the project as proposed. There was also an alternative of a sill, I believe, mentioned in the BIMS report. How would you compare the ecological benefits or lack thereof of the two?
When I looked at the project, there was the sill on the Cabin Creek side, and the breakwater was proposed on the Chisholm Creek side. Mm-hmm. So they're really two separate hydrodynamic conditions. So in that regard, there was really those two to respond to. The latter, the sill that Mr. Reynolds has shown they showed at the Wetlands Board meeting was to display what that type of system may look like in that particular shoreline. So the impacts of the breakwater system on the subaqueous are greater, but you're talking about a sill system, which is typically a marsh creation, and the breakwater system, which is typically a beach situation. So you're really kind of looking at that in almost kind of two different capacities. And beaches, I would argue, are things that are really minimal in the Chesapeake Bay over a period of years. Marshes are, creating marshes is admirable, but there's quite a bit of tidal marsh acreage in the Chesapeake Bay. And so anytime an opportunity to see an area where a beach can be created, I personally was supporting that particular methodology in that location.
All right. The next question, if the sand is flowing east to west, and first, do you agree with that?
I think a picture would be appropriate.
Yeah.
Brandon, Mr. Holmes.
If the sand, well, first of all, do you agree that the sand is flowing east to west, coming around from the Elk River there and flowing up?
I would agree with that assessment, that this material is being driven down and coming around this particular area. But when I look at this bar system along here, and this is also probably a sandier material, sand, whereas this material is a tidal flat, a combination of mud and sand and silt, so the dynamics are a wee bit different.
But if you remember the earlier imagery with the dredge channels and through a series of time imagery, you actually kind of see this coming in from this side. You see sand going around this side. Typically, when you see the material coming in this way, it's typically kind of being driven onshore and up into here, probably straight up from the south. So you have a combination of material going in different directions, depending on the impinging wind waveline. The question is, this material I think is probably coming in here mostly from the south. And so, you know, I think you get it driven this way, you get it driven across from the other direction. It's a finer material, and it appears to be, this whole channel system seems to be migrating into it.
Well, if that's the case, then the proposed system with this kind of curve-shaped thing, right there where it has been building up, that would keep the sand from the channel. It would appear to me it would keep the
sand. I think in some portion of that transport, yes. Mm-hmm.
But is there any reason to believe that if the sand is coming up from the side that you just that this thing on the side would deflect that sand into blocking that creek or not?
I don't think that thing is typically going to have any, because if it is a rock structure, because it is very dissipative, that it's going to have impacted any more than it's being impacted now. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure I can put an actual number on it. But the material within the system, it's coarse sand, I think it's the way it's designed to remain in there even during storm attack.
Well, that's the sand that would be deposited.
That's correct.
The 6,500.
Right.
Or whatever. But the sand coming up from the south, because of this angle, it's going to be trapped.
Well, I think you're going to catch some within the system. Yeah. Sure.
No reason to believe it would blow up into the creek.
Well, like I said, I don't think, because of the way it's turned, I don't think it's, and because it is a dissipated system, I don't think, you know, you have that trend now, and I don't think it's going to make it any worse than it already is.
Further questions? Mr. Robbins, then Mr. Tiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a couple, if I could, Mr. Hardaway. The applicant described the system as being designed as a closed system, and also that the spur was designed, the staff indicated that the spur was designed to anchor the nourishment.
Correct.
Speaking of the nourishment that was going to be added behind the breakwaters, would you agree with those characterizations from a design perspective?
I would agree with those, yes.
Well, and just getting back to the discussion about the environmental impacts and ecological services, there were some concerns that we heard today from the stakeholders about those issues. Back in the 1950s, before the site was manipulated, it appeared to be a combination of marsh with some sandy pockets.
Yeah.
How would you characterize the expected ecological services associated with the proposed project relative to the status quo? In other words, right now you've got a revetment along that shoreline, and if that's converted into a sandy beach, would that not be a significantly different?
It would be. I think, in my opinion, it's a more positive than what you have there now. As I say, there is also the sand issue, which we have less and less of that around the bay. I think there was also a discussion about there was some indication that rock was a sterile material. The Corps of Engineers back in the 90s looked at rock structures themselves as habitat and found them to be productive in terms of organisms utilizing them, fish and those types of things. So, you know, in that respect, you're obviously trading one environment habitat for another, and these have been approved, you know, through time as being acceptable trade-offs in terms of providing shore protection. So, I'm sure I've answered your question.
Well, I think the point is that there's got to be a difference between what's there now, which is a riprap revetment,
Well, it's just broken concrete is what it
having
is.
Having sandy beach.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't. I think it's a better trade-off to have the beach than to have the broken concrete here.
Mr. Tiger?
Yeah, there was some discussion of risk, and I didn't know if there's any way you could portray the risk that the protesters might be having to endure at this point, and also talk about what would happen. Two questions: what would happen in the future if there weren't any dredging, and would we see accretion and filling of these channels in the future with no dredging?
I think the channels are filling in now. So I think that trend will continue unless there's some maintenance dredging. Like I said, the sand, the coarse sand that's put in there, I mean, the systems that we've seen over time tend to hold, the pocket beach is a very stable shore platform, and they do a very well, do a good job of holding that material. Once you get the vegetation across the back, I mean, you've seen some of the slides that Mr. Reynolds has. I mean, it's a very tough, robust, vegetated back shore. I believe the Yorktown project was brought into play about losing sand. Well, Yorktown is a little bit different issue from that perspective. I mean, it's a public beach. They don't want grass growing on it. In fact, they rake it to make sure it doesn't come in. So when a storm comes in, it blows it into the street. And so in that respect, they do lose some sand, and that's why that's being maintained in that capacity. They don't want a dune across the back shore because it is a public beach for people to use. Once this thing gets knitted in, I think you'll have a very robust shoreline protection system.
Other questions? I do have one, or just a clarification.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Bavosa brought up the point that there was not specifically a report per se from you in this specific record.
That's correct.
Okay, I'd like to read from the staff report that we have. Okay. Mr. Hardaway cautions that reducing the offshore location of the proposed Trainum breakwater will steepen the back slope and potentially create an unstable design that will leave the upland susceptible to erosion. He further advised that the Trainum shoreline must be nourished artificially for the structure to work effectively. In fact, the spur portion of the project is included in the design to prevent movement of the sand along the shoreline and into the nearby channels. Mr. Hardaway believes that this structure will more evenly disperse the wave energy reflection generated from a southeasterly wind along its length. The existing revetment, conversely, allows for a more focused and closer wave strike at the canal mouth, increasing the potential for bottom scour, and a review of the available aerial photography documents ongoing shoaling of the canal entrance. Is that, in fact, the information that you personally conveyed to the staff, and would that be your information if it were to be included in the report?
That's correct.
Further questions?
Mr. I have one question.
Mr. Tankard.
Mr. Green and the property owner across the creek mentioned proper notice. Is there any discussion about that that we could?
Brandon.
Sure. Can I go to a slide?
Yes, you may. And it may be important if you can to identify what slide number that is. Thank you, Mr. Hardaway.
Yes.
What slide number that is in your slide presentation for the record?
Okay, let me do that. I need to look at it really quickly. Slide number four.
Proceed.
Okay. On the issue of adjacent property ownership and our normal notification to adjacent property owners, Mr. Green's property is across the waterway. This is Cabin Creek. He's not adjacent to the property. We get to those people via the public notice in the newspaper, and we contact adjacent property owners by letter, and we did so on July 1st, 2009.
As a matter of clarification, I like to use my piece of property, which I own to the slope of the marsh. I had absolutely no right whatsoever across the way because I didn't own. The person next door to me, if she owns all the way down to there and into the marsh and wants to basically do an improvement there, because I have no standing whatsoever except down to the toe of the slope, I'm not considering adjoining property.
So, in fact, we did give proper notice?
As far as we're concerned, yes. Further questions?
And public notice was given
a number of different ways.
A number of different ways to all other parties who may be concerned.
That's correct. That's the purpose for the newspaper ad. With general circulation in that specific area. Matters before the commission.
I move the adoption stamp recommendation.
Is there a second to the motion?
I'll second it.
Dr. McConaughey seconds. Further discussion.
I'd just like to state that I think that the protestants' complaints have been properly addressed, and I think to the best that science can identify that this project is not going to harm the navigable waterways. In fact, there may be some aid to protecting some of the southerly flow transport from coming into the waterways. And based on that, there's no doubt that this project, the benefits outweigh any type of detriments.
Mr. Robbins, did you have further comment?
Well, I did. Just as a motion, and I speak in support of it. But I think we've seen that the state of the practice in terms of the shoreline protection has evolved very dramatically over the last 30 years. And so while a riprap abutment might have been the proper solution at that point in time, today the state of science is significantly different, and there were concerns that were expressed by the stakeholders about the potential loss of ecological function, but I think as we've heard today, the trade-off is actually a positive in that respect. Historically, there was a marsh and some pocket beaches in the area that did provide ecological services, and those have been heavily manipulated through time. Now that we have a revetment that's in fact deteriorating at the site, or allowing some major ongoing erosion, and so I think this is a very comprehensive solution to the problem that reflects the best available science that's been delivered, I think, by BIMS. It's a very much a state-of-the-art solution, I think, that the agent has developed, and it enjoys the imprimatur of the scientific advisors here at the commission. So I think ultimately it's not a small solution to the problem, but I think it's an appropriate one. And I think we've heard pretty consistently from our own professional staff as well as members that this is a good solution to the potential or to the erosion problem at the site. And furthermore, I think the risk and concerns that have been raised and addressed relative to shoaling, I think the risk of shoaling, in fact, will not be increased by the project because of the spur that's designed to account for that.
Further comment. Mr. Lane?
I agree with Mr. Robbins that this is a state-of-the-art design and proposal before us. However, it appears that the evidence is that a sill alternative would be provide a much smaller intrusion upon the state subaqueous lands and would perhaps have the same, in all probability, would have the same benefit to the landowner as far as providing erosion control. So I think an alternative, a sill alternative, would be simpler, and we give up less state land by doing that. So I'm opposed to it.
Further comment? All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. 1-0, Mr. Lane. Thank you very much for your presentation. We will now be in recess until about 1:15, and then we will take up the rest of a marathon.